Well, I'd like to thank Gail and Barry for that beautiful music. And also congratulations to the graduates. Well, Shannon and I live over on the other side of the mountains now, and on the way over, I noticed that Lake Ketchelis, which is generally called Stump Lake, is actually full. I mean, all the way full, clear to the spillway, which I've only seen that I remember once other one other time in my life. So that'll be good for the farmers over there this year. Well, today I'm going to give a sermon that, thinking about it, I would rather not give. I would rather talk smooth words, talk about maybe something else that's a little more pleasant. But I would like to give this message anyway. This really came about from Clyde Kylo's sermon a couple weeks ago. And as you recall, he was talking about how things can happen very rapidly. And he was talking as an example of the Berlin Wall coming down and how that happened so fast, and that world events can happen rapidly, that to the average person they seem to just be almost immediate, just instantaneous. Of course, we know that our personal lives can turn on a dime. A lot of us have experienced that either through, you know, death of a loved one or an accident or something like that, that our lives can just change in a seeming instant, and sometimes an instant. And as Mr. Kylo was saying, the Bible is full of instances where God calls these changes rapid, that in one day or in an hour, something will happen. I'd like to quote part of the article, of course, in the latest World News and Prophecy. There's an article entitled The Element of Surprise. And in that, he goes through the example that he did in his sermon about the Berlin Wall and how things were happening in the background to make that happen, but that it, to the average person in the world, it was very rapid. Then he talks about in Matthew 25 about how in the parable of the 10 virgins, he says, carefully read through the parable of the virgins in Matthew 25, 6 through 13, and put yourself in the shoes of the foolish. Can you hear the angst and desperation in their voices crying, Lord, Lord, open to us? Can you sense the depth of feeling and the depth of feeling Christ had and his sense of urgency as he pleads his point? Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Understand very clearly what Christ is telling us. When those things begin to happen, we will either have a sense of urgency before or a sense of panic after. Those who do not have a sense of urgency will be stunned by the suddenness of the events unfolding. This article isn't really about prophecy. It's about our response to prophecy. And I'll say the same thing for this sermon. It's not really about what could happen. It's about our response to knowing what could happen. And he goes on, where we are concerned individually, being given an understanding of prophecy is only as good as our reaction to it. Both history and fulfilled prophecy stand as witnesses that human nature is easily lulled to sleep. Ignorance, deception, skepticism, and apathy work powerfully to depress the spiritual senses. And that's very, very true. And many, many people outside of the religious realm understand that. It's like many times we'll read that, you know, speaking of the American public, that, you know, their ignorance is only outdone by their apathy. And it's not a good thing for us to be wrapped up in. If we are not stirred to spiritual action by understanding prophecy, then what good is it for us to know all of these things? So that Mr. Kylo is saying is the same thing that I'd like to emphasize in this sermon. That it's what we do with what we know that's important. And we need this sense of urgency. Let's turn to Luke 21, starting in verse 34. This is right after, this is in the harmony of the Gospels. You'll see that Matthew 24, Luke 21, and Mark 14 are talking about the Olivet prophecy. And this is what he says towards the end. Luke 21, 34. It says, "Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life, so that that day come upon you unaware. For as a snare shall it come upon them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore and pray always that you be accounted worthy to escape all of these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." So it's easy for us to let the cares of this world blind us to what is happening. Either that or just take our mind off of what is really important in life. It's interesting that it says, as a snare, it will come upon those who dwell on the face of the earth. A snare is a device designed to catch animals, and sometimes to catch people, depending on what circumstance you're in. But a snare is a very deceptive thing. A snare is designed so that the animal walking along the path doesn't know what's about to happen to them. And then all of a sudden, they're grabbed in this trap. And it's without knowledge. It's very deceptive. And sometimes, even when you're looking for it, you can be trapped anyway. A snare is that sort of thing. And what Christ is telling us is that, you know, don't get preoccupied with this world, or it will come as a snare. You will be surprised. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes in the world today. There's a lot going on that is not reported, that obviously there's a lot going on that we don't know about, we probably shouldn't know about, because it hasn't, you know, the people that are planning it, you know, it hasn't happened yet. But when it's revealed, it will be all of a sudden. I think back to the events of May 18th, 1980, when Mount St. Helens erupted. And when it was happening, I remember distinctly when it was happening that the earthquake started, the harmonic tremors started, then the bulge started growing, and all of these things, and it was building and building and building. But it, when it was happening, it seemed sort of slowly, because we're, you know, we want things to happen fast. You know, if we're not doing four things at once, you know, we're not getting anything done. So then all of a sudden it erupted. But when you look back and look at the dates and when it happened, it's all compacted in history now, and you look at it and say, why was anybody in their right mind anywhere near that thing? And that's sort of what's happening now. There are any number of things that I could talk about, but I want to zero in on one thing today. And I'd like to talk about the United States economy. I'd like to talk about money. Money is always an interesting subject. And I would really rather not talk about this, because it's kind of scary when you talk about it. But it's happening. And I'm not going to talk about why or who or get into anything like that. I'm just going to talk about what is happening, because I don't want to get into things that just muddy the water. But what is happening? And what does it mean to us? What's in store for us economically? Can we sustain the status quo? Is it sustainable? I'd like to give a little background first. This obviously is a giant subject, and I had been doing a lot of study about it and so forth when Mr. Kylo gave his sermon, and I thought, you know, this is something that we really need to look at. But just as a historical background, being as we're talking about money, let's go back in the history of the United States. We once had gold coins. We once had something called a double eagle, which was a $20 gold piece. We had a $10 gold piece. We had silver dollars. Our money had an intrinsic value. It was worth something. You know, they say 50 years ago, an ounce of gold would buy a good suit. Today it's still well. An ounce of gold used to be worth $32. Now it's worth somewhere between $600 and $700. So our money had intrinsic value. Something happened in 1913. It's interesting. I stumbled across a book, and it was called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And I thought, wow, that's an odd name. But actually, the Federal Reserve was hatched on Jekyll Island. So in 1913, basically the United States government gave over the control of its money supply to a private corporation called the Federal Reserve, which was the Federal Reserve was actually owned by member banks. There are, I think, 8 banks that own the Federal Reserve, but it's a private corporation. And they started issuing money, which at first were, they had silver certificates. Maybe some of you remember certificates that were redeemable for real money. And I remember distinctly having silver certificates that said you could take them and get a dollar's worth of silver with this piece of paper. Okay, eventually we went off of the gold standard, and today we have money that is not redeemable. I have a $20 bill here, and you can read everywhere on this $20 bill, and it never says that it's redeemable for anything. It simply says it's a Federal Reserve note, and it's legal money for debts all public and private. But we'll see later, you know, what is this worth? You know, I mean, seriously, what is it worth? It's worth what we think it's worth. See, at this stage of history, we're playing a confidence game. And as long as people think that our money is worth something, then that's what it's worth. Now, it's backed by the full, you know, confidence of the United States government. But, you know, that means different things to different people. So our money supply is Federal Reserve notes. Now this $20 bill I just put away it's a promise to pay, basically. And our bank accounts are electronic promises to pay. So that's the state we are in right now, as far as our money is concerned. Now we need to switch and talk about something else. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 15. God told Israel how to live, what to do to be a viable nation. And those principles are alive today. They don't change. And we used to be a Christian nation. We're basically a secular nation now. You know, I don't live in the same nation that I lived in as a child. It's really a different environment that we live in now. But we used to live more by godly principles than we do now. And in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 6, he says, "For the Lord your God blessed you and he promised you, and you shall lend unto nations, unto many nations, but you shall not borrow. And you shall reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over you. And then in Deuteronomy 28, starting in verse 12, it's very similar. It says, the Lord shall open unto you his good treasure. The heaven will give the rain unto your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand. And you shall not lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. And the Lord shall make you the head and not the tail. And you shall be above only, and you shall not be beneath, in that you hearken unto the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you to this day to observe and to do them. So when we observe sound financial principles, then obviously God blessed those. And we used to be the world's greatest creditor nation. We used to lend to other nations. But now we are the greatest debtor nation in the world. We owe more than any other nation. Now, how much debt do we have? There's I forget which corporation, but they put up a big reader board in New York where it kept track of the national debt because they wanted to raise awareness that, you know, they weren't happy with the United States fiscal policy. So they put up this big reader board, and it was clicking away the dollars, you know, as the debt rose. In 1989, the debt, now this is only the debt that the United States owes as far as treasury bills are concerned. This is instruments that they have sold people and gotten money for. There's other liabilities as well. But in 1989, it was $2.7 trillion. Now that's, you know, $1 trillion is a lot of money. You know, that's more money than Bill Gates has, you know. That's 1,000 billion is a trillion. And 1 billion is 1,000 million. So 1 trillion is 1,000,000,000,000. That's a lot. Now it is $8.4 trillion. So it's $8.4 trillion. Now they had to raise the debt limit recently because the debt limit was $8.2 trillion and they needed to exceed that. Now I'll read something about that later. But our national debt increases by $2.43 billion. That's $2.43 billion every day. That's a lot. I could work for that. That's $20,000 every second. And as of recently, every family in here, their share is $90,000. $90,000. Now this is the hard cost government debt. Then there are other government liabilities as well. It's like, you know, we're taxed, but we also pay Social Security. Okay, and Social Security used to be a trust fund. The idea was we would pay in, the government would hold it, pay us back with interest. Okay, basically, when that money goes to the government, they spend it. So they also have the liability of paying back the money that they borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund, which is, I don't have that figure, but it's a lot. And then, of course, on top of the government debt, we have consumer debt. Now, we basically live in a consumer-driven economy. When people are happy, when people feel that things are good, they buy things. And that fuels our economy. Now recently, housing prices have been increasing. So it makes it easy for everyone to use their house like a piggy bank. I know I did. You know, especially through hard times in my life, you know, if you could, you get in a hard situation, you know, you get an equity line on your house, you suck money out, you take care of your liabilities. Generally, it's a small interest rate. You know, I mean, fiscally speaking, if you're in trouble, that's a great thing to do. Well, people have done that, of course. So consumer debt is in the trillions. So we're in debt. Not only is our, you know, our money is worth what we, you know, what we think it is, we're just horribly in debt. When the government borrows money, okay, where does that come from? They feel that in the next few years, our debt will rise to $10 trillion, the hard government debt. Where does that come from? Well, first of all, the government sells treasury bills, things like that, different securities, and they get money that way. Now, we also run a huge trade deficit. This last year was $800 billion trade deficit. That means that the United States is buying, you know, as a whole, more than it's selling. So we have this imbalance. So $800 billion left the country. Okay, where'd it go? What happened to it? Okay, well, our biggest creditor is China. China last year bought $200 billion of our securities because obviously it's in China's interest to keep us afloat because we're their biggest market. You know, our United States companies have found that if they stop production in the United States, have it produced in China, and then shipped back to the United States, it works better for them. Sometimes it's a profit motive, sometimes it's survival. We used to buy compressors from Tecumseh, and Tecumseh, Michigan, the whole town is about Tecumseh. You know, they make small engines, they make compressors and so forth for refrigeration. And I was talking to one of the reps, and he said that they simply might have to go offshore to produce their compressors and engines simply for survival, because they simply could not compete producing them in the United States. So China, in these large industrial areas, produces just a tremendous amount of product. But they also buy a tremendous amount of our debt. And I'd like to read sections of an article. This article is entitled Economic Suicide. And it will explain some of this in greater detail. It says, anybody who has been lending money to the federal government by buying T-bills and its other debt instruments received a brutal 1-2 punch last week. It was hopefully a sobering experience, causing them to question why they would want to hold any U.S. government paper. The Washington Post landed the first punch with the following report on March 6th. It says, Treasury Secretary John Snow notified Congress on Monday that the administration has now taken, this is quote, all prudent and legal actions, unquote, including tapping certain government retirement funds to keep from hitting the $8.2 trillion national debt limit. Of course, they've raised it now. Treasury officials, briefing congressional aides last week, said that the government will run out of maneuvering room to keep from exceeding the current limit sometime during the week of March 20th. The second punch was delivered a couple days later by this Dow Jones Newswire's dispatch, and this is headlined Washington. The U.S. government ran a monthly budget deficit of $119.2 billion in February, an all-time monthly record that was still slightly less than forecast, according to the Treasury report Friday. The February federal government deficit was 5% greater than a year earlier, according to the Treasury Department's monthly budget statement. So they spent $119.2 billion, and that's just a deficit in February. So that's a tremendous amount of money. These two reports make clear the dire financial straits the federal government is facing, but its financial position is even worse than it appears. The $8.2 trillion debt limit, and that's, and then this is in quotes, that has proven inadequate to meet the federal government's borrowing needs, covers only its direct liabilities. In other words, this $8.2 trillion is the total amount of dollars owed to all holders of U.S. government debt instruments. Excluded from this total debt are all the federal government's other liabilities, which total another $38 trillion. In the 2005 financial report of the United States government, U.S. Comptroller General David Walker reported that the federal government's fiscal exposures now total more than $46 trillion, up from $20 trillion in the year 2000. So in the year 2000, the government's liabilities, this is including Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all of those types of things that aren't direct debt instruments, was $20 trillion 6 years ago. So that has doubled in 6 years. Then he goes on, he talks about what the different Fed chairmen have done to control certain things. And now the government and the Federal Reserve can create money. That's something that you and I can't do, but they can create money. Now, I don't know if this was last year or this year, but they have created $1 trillion. So now I'd like to read this part. It says, today's monetary system is not only broken, it's completely crazy. For this reason, I found the following quote in the current issue of Barron's to be of interest. It's by Richard Doherty from the March 8th issue of his newsletter. I can't even pronounce the name. But anyway, he says, what a scam. Last week, this is the week before last, the Fed snaps its fingers and creates $2.2 billion and then uses it to buy $2.2 billion in government debt. So they created $2.2 billion and bought T-bills with it to give the government more money. What can you do except laugh at the sheer audacity? Somehow a government creating more and more money and spending it is not, for the first time in history, going to turn out to be a bad thing? And especially one where the money is just paper and computer blips that they can create on a whim. Of course, I sigh wearily as I note that the banks themselves are in on it. They bought up another $13 billion of government debt the week before last. Foreign central banks continue to soak up government debt, and they swallow another $7.6 billion a week as well. The government sells debt to get money to spend on its deficits, and the bank creates the money to buy the debt. The debt and the money supply both expand, and it expands to create a bigger and more expensive government and higher prices. This is economic suicide. Indeed, it truly is economic suicide, but it's even worse than that. It's also monetary suicide, monetary homicide. The dollar as we know it is being killed, poisoned by debt from the hand of the federal government and the Federal Reserve. So far, it's been a slow death with few people watching, but that's about to change. With the horrific new amounts of debt being injected into the dollar's weary remains, its death is not far off. So that's pretty sobering. Now, a lot of these reports, you have to understand, it's like the reports that come out of people who are selling gold, let's say. you have to understand are tainted. But what you get is a picture of all of this that is very sobering, because the facts are the facts. Now, what you try to do with those facts is, you know, where's it going to end, kind of thing. So what does all this debt do to the dollar? One of the things it does, of course, is it weakens it against other currencies. It's an interesting article out of the London Sunday Times. This caught my eye because it was such a reputable paper. I thought, wow. You know, because our economic condition is so geared to confidence, you know, you'll read about the Consumer Confidence Index, because, you know, it's based on confidence. So here's an article that says the dollar starts the big slide against major currencies. This is by David Smith, economics editor. It says the dollar has embarked on a big decline that will see it fall against all leading currencies, according to analysts. The plunge is being prompted by America's $800 billion current account deficit, they say. The dollar has been under pressure following last weekend's meeting of the G7 finance ministers and central bankers, which emphasized global imbalances and said currencies should reflect economic fundamentals. Then China raised its key interest rate to 5.85, its first hike in months, and Ben Bernanke, the new Federal Reserve chairman, hinted that American rates would pause at 5% after a rise in May. Analysts say that without interest rate support, the dollar will be weighed down heavily by America's imbalances. So part of what has to happen is that interest rates have to rise, which of course will directly affect us, to draw investors to buy United States securities. I think this is it, said Tony Norfield, global head of currency strategy at ABN AMERO. The dollar has been supported by high yields, but markets are saying that is no longer enough. The question for policymakers is going to be how to manage the dollar's decline. It won't be a one-way street, but the fall is likely to be biggest against Asian currencies. I'd like to interject here that there's, right now, the Asian currencies are tied to the dollar. So it's like we have so much trade with China, and right now the currencies are tied. I thought it was tied directly to the dollar, but it's not. It's a little different than that. But they're creating what's called the ACU, which is the Asian currency unit, which eventually may be like the euro. There's also talk of an AMERO, which would be the peso dollar Canadian dollar, just to be able to duke it out on the world stage. But they're talking about how the Chinese money needs to be freed up and be able to float to show its true value, which could be like a 20% difference. So, you know, imagine how that would impact if all of a sudden everything from China was 20% higher. It says the euro has already risen to an 11-month high of more than $1.26. You know, a few years ago you could buy a euro for 90 cents. Now it costs $1.26. While the dollar is at a 3-month low of 113.70 against the yen, the Canadian dollar, also known by traders as the loonie, rose to a 28-year high on Friday, boosted by a hike in Canadian interest rates. So those of you who are going to Kelowna for the feast, you know, it used to be, you know, you took your dollar up to Canada, you got $1.40 or $1.50. I don't know what it is today, but recently it was trading at $1.12. So it's, you know, it's the dollar is declining. So what, you know, we're pretty much swimming in debt. So what keeps this afloat? What holds it all together? Well, currently, the United States dollar enjoys the position of being the world's reserve currency. The dollar has traditionally been a way for countries to preserve value. They had dollars in their reserves. Also, currently, all oil transactions are made in dollars. So all oil transactions are made in dollars. Now, I happen to be kind of watching the currency exchanges on the computer, and probably 6 weeks ago now, the United Arab Emirates said that, you know, we'll accept dollars or accept euros for our oil. And the dollar just took a dive, just on that news, just poof, dove against the euro. In the latest World News and Prophecy, right after the article by Clyde Kylo, there's one about Vladimir Putin. Russian resurgence in a unipolar world. This is an article called Vladimir Putin and the Rise of the Petro-Ruble. Because what's happening is that the dollar is starting to come under pressure as far as being the world reserve currency. It's not the only game in town anymore. It says, on May 10th, Russian President Vladimir Putin ignited a firestorm that is bound to sweep across the global economy. In his State of the Nation speech to Parliament, he announced that Russia is planning to make the ruble internationally convertible so that it could be used in oil and natural gas transactions. Presently, oil is dominated exclusively in dollars, or denominated, sorry, and sold through the New York Mercantile Exchange or the London Petroleum Exchange, both owned by American investors. If Russia proceeds with its plan, the ruble will go nose to nose with the dollar in the open market, sending several billions of surplus greenbacks back to the United States. This could potentially send the American economy into free fall, triggering recession or an extended period of hyperinflation. And then this is a quote from Mr. Putin. The ruble must become a more widespread means of international transactions. To this end, we need to open a stock exchange in Russia to trade in oil, gas, and other goods to be paid for in rubles. Currently, the central banks around the world carry large stockpiles of dollars to use in their purchases of oil. This gives the U.S. a virtual monopoly on oil transactions. It also forces reluctant nations to continue using the dollar, even though it is currently underwritten by $8.4 trillion of national debt. Putin's plan is similar to that of Iran, which announced that it would open an oil exchange on Kish Island in 2 months. The exchange would allow oil transactions to be made in petro-euros, thus discarding the dollar. So there are things on the horizon that will shake the status quo. It says the United States must protect its dollar monopoly in the oil trade, or it will lose the advantage of being the world's reserve currency. As the reserve currency, the U.S. can maintain its towering $8.4 trillion national debt and $800 billion trade deficit without fear of soaring interest rates or hyperinflation. Trillions of greenbacks are constantly circulating in oil transactions, just as hundreds of billions are stockpiled in foreign banks. So what keeps it afloat is this tremendous amount of money that is necessary in the world to keep the global economy going. In a recent article by Dave Kimball, entitled Collapse of the Petrodollar Looming, the author provides the details of Russia's importance to the world oil market. Russia's oil exports represent 15.2% of the world's export trade in oil, making it much more significant player than Iran, with 5.8%. Russia also produces 25.8% of the world's gas exports, while Iran is only entering this market as an exporter. Venezuela has 5.4% of the export market. And Venezuela has also said that if the United States attacks Iran, they will switch to the euro. So obviously it is not in Russia's interest to trade with its economic, with its European partners in dollars any more than it would be for the US to trade with Canada in rubles. Putin can strengthen the Russian economy and improve Russia's prestige in the world as an energy superpower by transitioning to rubles. And there's just one last thing, there's a little interesting blurb by Bill O'Grady from A.G. Edwards Company. He says, if one day the world's largest oil producers demand euros for their barrels, it would be the financial equivalent of a nuclear strike. So basically, you know, there's a chance that this could happen. Now, I'm not saying, you know, when, but go on your computer and Google and type in economic collapse. And it'll be interesting what you find, because they're not talking about if, you know, they're talking about when and what it's going to be like. Now, hopefully it won't happen. Hopefully it'll be a soft landing. You know, I don't want any of this to happen. Let's turn over to Revelation 10. There's an interesting little... In Revelation 10, it talks about an angel that comes down, and he has in his hand a little book, and we've probably heard of this little book. And he talks about different things about it. And then verse 8, and the voice I heard from heaven spoke to me again and said, go take the little book, which is open in the hand of the angel that stands upon the sea and the earth. And I went to the angel and said to him, give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make your belly bitter, but it shall be in your mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up. And it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as that I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said to me, you must prophesy again for many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. So to me, this has always meant, you know, decades ago we studied prophecy and we spoke about prophecy, and it was, oh, it was intriguing, you know, and it was interesting, and it was just so cool to know everything, and or think we knew everything. But now that it's happening, it's very bitter. You know, if you're a true patriot and love your country and watch this happen, it's very aggravating, and it's a bitter thing. But what should it do to us and for us? You know, there is a spiritual side of this. There are several things that this should do for us. It should create a sense of urgency, just like Clyde Kyla was saying. Also, we need to do what we can do while we can do it. You know, we do have time to do some things. We have the power, and we should do them. We should walk through the open doors that we have to preach the gospel, to warn people. You know, we still have time. 1 John 2 and verse 15. You know, we really need to get our priorities straight. 1 John 2:15 says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passes away, and the lust thereof, but he that does the will of God abides forever. So I think that in thinking about what our priorities are and in looking at this and knowing that things can happen suddenly. You know, I don't know when or necessarily, you know, how this will play out. You know, maybe it'll be better than it could be, and I hope and pray that it will be for all of our sakes. But we need to trust God through this. You know, there's no way to think yourself through something like this. You know, it's like, well, how can I prepare and how can I, you know, you get into this bunker mentality. You know, although we have an excavator on the property, I guess I could make a bunker. No, I'm just kidding. But I'd like to conclude by reading the conclusion of this article. Because even though this is sobering, that's fine. We need to be sobered. We need to be sober and work out our salvation and be willing and able and ready to do what we need to do at the end of this age. But at the end of Clyde's article, he says, watch for the future, keeping your eyes on the kingdom of God. You know, we have a goal and we're pressing toward that goal. It says, watch in the present, keeping your eyes on what is happening in the world, understanding the prophecies being fulfilled. Watch by learning lessons of the past, keeping your eyes on the rearview mirror of history, learning the lessons of how suddenly events can unfold when God decides to intervene. Above all, remember, those who have a sense of urgency now will not have a sense of panic later. When these things surely come to pass, the choice is ours. So even though in some ways this is a sobering message, there is, of course, light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, even though we know that these things must come to pass, we still have a job to do, and we should have an urgency doing it and to do the work of God while we still can.